The following podcast contains spoilers and graphic content. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to Criminal Adaptations, the show where we take a look at some of your favorite movies and the true crime stories that inspired them. I'm Ashley. I'm a clinical psychologist and forensic evaluator in the state of Oregon.
And I'm Remy. I spent over a decade working in the film and television industry in Los Angeles, California.
And welcome back, everyone. We are here ready to bring you a unique white-collar crime case for Season 2, Episode 2. How are you doing, Remy?
I am doing okay. We have been recording these episodes of this season a little out of order, so I actually forgot that this was our second episode. I thought it was a couple more episodes down the line. This is going to be an interesting one, one of our non-murder-related true crime stories, and it is a Matt Damon, Steven Soderbergh film called The Informant. Had you ever heard of this movie before we decided to do it for the podcast, Ashley?
I had heard of the movie, but I had not seen it, still have not seen it, and I didn't even know what it was about until you kind of explained a little bit while we were picking episodes to cover, and then I read the book that the movie is based on. So now I can say I know a lot about Mr. Mark Whitaker and his various crimes against agricultural company ADM.
I had not really heard of the true story at all before, but I was familiar with the film. I actually saw this back when it first came out. I remember watching it and really thinking it was a funny, quirky, standout performance from Damon, and I am a big Steven Soderbergh fan as well. Not all of his films are great, but he has such a variety of films that I just find his work to be very interesting and unique and creative. He has done the Oceans movies, he did Magic Mike. He has done all sorts of variety of films, and this being one of them.
All I remember about this movie was the cover photo of Matt Damon just wearing these big spectacles with his mouth like gaped open into half smile, half shock and awe, and just kind of staring up at the title of The Informant! Exclamation mark.
He really does look like a doofus, and he really got into and embraced the look, which I will get into shortly. With that, how about we just dive into it, Ashley? Should we get started on this?
Yeah, tell me about how this movie came to be.
Let's do it, because there is a lot to cover on this one. Neither of us knew very much about price fixing going into this, and I still don't know if I have a firm grasp on it all, but we're going to do our best, and this one was a challenge for us, folks. This one required our full attention to really get the story here. The Informant is a 2009 film directed by Steven Soderbergh and written by Scott Z. Burns, based on the 2000 nonfiction book The Informant by Kurt Eckenwald?
That sounds right.
The film stars Matt Damon, Scott Bakula, Joel McHale, and Heavenly Creatures alum Melanie Lynskey.
She just pops up everywhere, so I wouldn't be surprised if we see her again shortly.
She is a very good actress and one of the few actresses out there that I believe most people do not realize is actually from New Zealand and has a New Zealand accent that she literally never uses in any movie or TV show she does. Anyway, initially, screenwriter Scott Burns brought the book to director Steven Soderbergh and actor Matt Damon with the idea of adapting the story into a screenplay. After reading the book and both liking the idea, Soderbergh felt that the film should be written as a comedy rather than a drama in order to separate the film from similar white-collar crime movies like 1999's The Insider. It was also Soderbergh's idea to add the exclamation point to the title to emphasize the comedic aspect further, which I do think it successfully does. That little informant exclamation point just adds to the silliness of the overall film, I think.
It jumps out at you, that's for sure.
I would also like to add that the movie's soundtrack, composed by Marvin Hamlisch, further contributes to this comedic feel as well, so here's just a little sample of that.
I
And that is the type of music that is being played throughout the entire film, which really gives it a lighthearted, jovial feel, in my opinion. Soderbergh has described the film's story as restarting every 20 minutes due to new information coming to light throughout the film. In 2002, after completing work on Ocean's 11, Soderbergh announced his intent to adapt the book, but according to Damon, it took nearly 7 years before they would finally get around to making the film.
I believe it. This book is over 600 pages long, and the author is a former writer for the New York Times who is actually covering this case in real time. He also had access to thousands upon thousands of audio recordings, transcripts. He met with Mark Whitaker several times. So this book is very, very dense. There's a lot of new information just constantly. So I imagine it was really hard to sift through to make a screenplay to fit into a 90-minute film.
Agreed. I know usually with these projects, it takes you about maybe a week, week and a half to finish these books. But with The Informant, it is a brick of a book, and you were diligently reading away on this novel for what seemed like weeks. We did this over the holiday break, and yeah, you were taking a lot of notes, and this book took up a lot of your time, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, I originally had over 20 pages of just typed notes that I had picked from the book that was just new information, so it took a while to first read the book and then type up all those notes and then whittle it down into a more manageable script.
For the film, Soderbergh also never met Mark Whitaker prior to filming and actually gave specific instructions to all of the actors not to get in touch with their real-life counterparts, which is an interesting choice, if I may say so.
As we uncover this story and all of the deception that was involved, particularly for Mark Whitaker, it would make sense why they kind of wanted to steer clear from trying to incorporate other characters' point of views.
Damon has described his character in the film as both the protagonist and the antagonist of the movie. All the situations he finds himself in are of his own creation, and yet he has a really good heart, Damon would say. To prepare for his role as Mark Whitaker, Damon purposefully gained 30 pounds prior to filming. He achieved this by eating hamburgers, pizza, and drinking lots of dark beer, which Damon has described as being really, really, really fun.
I imagine it must be kind of fun to just let loose for these actors that usually don't do so. But I also think the aftermath of this, when they have to then slim down 30 pounds for their next role, is not as pleasant.
Yes, I am sure that it was not as fun for him to get back in shape to do another Bourne movie after doing this film. The 30 pounds really does add to the character. Apparently, that was a choice by the director and Damon to make sure that the character never had any straight lines. They wanted him to just be full of curves, so he was never on the straight and narrow. He was always curving in some way. It's very subtle, but I think it works.
How metaphorical of them.
Damon also wore a wig, mustache, and fake nose to complete his transformation into Mark. Damon has gone into a bit more detail about this entire process in various interviews with the following quote. His face is also rounder than mine, so I had little things stuck in my gums to push my cheeks out. And I wore a fake mustache. Whitaker was also bald and wore a hairpiece, but the hairpiece was so good that no one knew he didn't have hair. It's actually a great metaphor for the character. It was right there in front of everybody, and nobody ever figured it out. And I didn't realize until this quote that Damon is wearing a wig in the film. It looks like his normal hair and could very easily be the character's natural hair. I think there is one scene where he adjusts his wig slightly. Again, it's very subtle, but I feel like it works very well.
Good, because there's nothing worse in a movie than a bad wig or hairpiece.
Yes, I'm looking at you, American Hustler. And finally, Damon would go on to describe Mark Whitaker as one of the greatest roles he's ever had the chance to play. Now, are you ready to get into the film The Informant, Ashley?
Yeah, strap in, people. It's going to be a wild ride.
It sure is. Our film begins with a warning that reads, "While this motion picture is based on real events, certain incidents and characters are composites and dialogue has been dramatized. So there." We are next introduced to Mark Whitaker, played by Matt Damon. describing the many uses of various products that contain corn to his young son as they merrily drive down a long stretch of freeway sandwiched between two large cornfields. In October of 1992, Mark arrives at his job in Decatur, Illinois, at a company called Archers Daniels Midland, or ADM for short, which specializes in corn-related products and are currently the top lysine manufacturers in the entire world. Can you tell me what lysine is, Ashley? I watched this whole film and I still couldn't tell you what lysine is.
Yes, I can. So lysine is an amino acid that's found in a bunch of food and supplements, and it essentially contributes to protein production.
I also have to point out that throughout the entire film, we hear Mark rambling on in an ADD-like fashion through voiceover about anything and everything that pops into his brain. So here's just a little sample of that.
Maybe everyone has a sentence like that, a little time bomb. I have the same tie as you, only the pattern's reversed. Dead. The last thing they'll ever say. Something like,
high fructose corn syrup.
He has lots of thoughts.
And that goes on throughout the entirety of the film. And it is interesting, during various meetings throughout the film, the voiceover will start going. So it's almost like Mark is zoning out and not listening to anything that the people are saying to him while he's just having these mundane thoughts go through his head. At work, Mark is updated on a situation involving a virus affecting the dextrose in one of their corn products, causing the company's production rate to plummet, resulting in ADM currently losing around $7 million a month, which Mark's boss, Mick Andreas, played by Tom Papa, is none too pleased with. At home that night, we are briefly introduced to Mark's wife Ginger, played by Melanie Lynskey, along with his three young children. Back at work the next day, Mark storms into his boss Mick's office ranting about supposedly receiving calls from a man named Mr. Nakawara from a Japanese company called Ajimoto, whom Mark claims that he's been speaking with on a semi-regular basis over the telephone for quite some time now. Mark then divulges to Mick that Mr. Nakawara alleges to know insider secrets about ADM, apparently leaked through a mole for the Ajimoto company working as an informant within ADM, who is also sabotaging the plant by injecting a virus into the plant's dextrose. So nefarious. Mark also says that Mr. Nakawara now wants $10 million to reveal the identity of his source. Mick responds to all this by asking Mark to try and lower the price a bit if he should receive another phone call from Mr. Nakawara. Mick also instructs Mark to keep all of this information confidential until ADM can figure out exactly who the mole is. But the next time Mark meets with his employers, he's informed that the company has already involved the FBI to come in and handle the situation, which really seems to irk Mark. That night, Mark stays up late into the evening, speaking with FBI Special Agents Brian Shepard, played by Scott Bakula, and Robert Herndon, played by Joel McHale, about all the details Mark has on Mr. Nakawara. The FBI also inquires to which phone line Mark would regularly have these calls with Mr. Nakawara, which Mark asserts was on a business line Mark had installed in his home some time ago. The FBI agents then propose installing a tap on Mark's phone line in order to record any future conversations with Mr. Nakawara, and Mark agrees without hesitation. The following evening, Mark and his wife are out to dinner when Mark covertly slides his wife a note informing her that the FBI will be at their home at 10 p.m. that night. What a way to break the news to your spouse, huh?
Why didn't he just say it? Why did he have to, like, write her a secret, secret note and slide it to her like a weirdo?
Mark sees himself as a bit of a spy throughout the film, so that's the only justification I can give to him acting this way. Back home, Ginger pleads with Mark to cooperate with the FBI and be truthful with them, but Mark feels that the right thing to do in this current situation is to toe the company line for the time being. Moments later, Special Agent Shepard from the FBI arrives at Mark's home and installs recording devices on Mark's phone line. After Agent Shepard has finished up and is just about to depart, he is stopped by Mark, who asks to speak with Agent Shepard one last time. At the request of Mark, the two men then take a seat in Agent Shepard's vehicle, where Mark proceeds to admit that he had lied about which phone line he had received the phone calls from Mr. Nakawara. When asked why Mark had lied, Mark claims that ADM had coached him to lie in order to divert the FBI's attention away from ADM's involvement in a price-fixing scheme involving lysine that the company was currently involved in.
Price fixing involves production companies meeting and secretly agreeing to set a price for a specific product and dividing up the market based on the amount of volume of the product that they're going to make to ensure a steady stream of income to avoid the companies needing to lower the prices to remain competitive due to increased availability of the product in the marketplace. So it's all supply and demand. It's a practice that directly benefits these larger companies involved in the scheme because they're then allowed to inflate the price of products. This also harms smaller companies as well as individual people like you and I who purchase the products with these specific ingredients because we're often paying more for the products than they need to be paid for or that they're even worth.
That is very deviously underhanded and subtle, something that I feel most people would never think about or even realize is going on.
It's really pretty interesting. It's been illegal in the United States for like 100 years. There's an act called the Sherman Act that directly outlaws price fixing. But it's one of those things that can be done pretty covertly and is extremely hard to investigate. Also, a lot of the times the FBI doesn't want to put in a lot of resources for crimes like this because they don't generate typically as much income from successful prosecutions, and they're just not as glamorous as some other white collar and criminal cases are.
That is very interesting. The reason that Mark had lied about which phone line he had been speaking to Mr. Nakarara was because he had also been having conversations on this same line involving price fixing, so ADM had supposedly told him to lie about which line he had been receiving the other calls on. Mark's reasoning for confessing all of this information to Agent Shepard is out of fear that ADM and Chevron, who is someone who he works with, not the car company, may eventually plan to make Mark the fall guy in the entire price-fixing scandal. The next day, Agent Shepard reports back to Springfield, Illinois, directly to the FBI, where he reports Mark's confession to his superiors, who then request a meeting with Mark directly. Back at ADM, Mark confronts Chevron about the situation he is now involved in and is freaking the fuck out, to say the least, and calls out, "Talk to Regina," just before storming out of the room. Regina doesn't exist, by the way. Chevron then calls Agent Shepard at the FBI to clarify which line the FBI had tapped in Mark's home. But of course, Agent Shepard is unable to reveal that information at this time. Chevron and Mick then immediately call a meeting with Mark at the conclusion of this call, where they all agree that ADM will no longer be cooperating with the FBI, which Mark eagerly agrees to. It is then during this specific meeting that Mark also receives a phone call from Agent Shepard requesting that Mark meet with his superiors from the FBI that weekend, which Mark, of course, eagerly agrees to. He literally is contradicting himself within seconds throughout this entire film.
He is very impulsive. He changes his mind a lot. So it is really just a whirlwind throughout his time as an FBI informant. One day he'll be like, "I can't do this anymore. I'm done." 2 hours later, he'll be like, "I got to participate. It's the right thing to do. I'm going to be promoted to ADM president once this is all revealed."
Mark just strikes me as a real people pleaser at times. He just wants to say whatever the person talking to him wants to hear. It is very detrimental to his life throughout this film.
I'll talk about this a little bit later, but there is supposedly some mental illness involved as well.
That weekend at Mark's home, Mark has his meeting with Agent Shepard's superiors from the FBI, where Mark provides them with dozens of expense reports containing travel arrangements for ADM executives to various cities around the world where ADM and other companies supposedly engage in price fixing.
Side note, most of these meetings did occur in other countries because America does have some of the harshest price fixing laws.
The FBI then questions Mark as to why he would divulge this information out of nowhere for seemingly no reason at all. Mark responds by simply asserting that he doesn't like to lie. The FBI then asks Mark if he'd be willing to wear a wire. The next time Mark meets up with Agent Shepard, Mark is asked to make a call to one of ADM's business partners in Japan, while Agent Shepard and his partner listen in on the other line in an attempt to record any conversations revolving around price fixing. After Mark makes the call, both agents seem relatively satisfied with Mark's cooperation and thank him for his help. Later, Mark is out to lunch with a friend and associate from ADM, where Mark offhandedly mentions the name of a Nigerian prince. We will come back to this later. Mexico City, December 1992. Mark has been traveling on business for some time now, while Agent Shepard and the FBI have made repeated attempts to get in contact with Mark. When Agent Shepard finally manages to get a hold of Mark on the phone, Mark says that ADM has now ceased all price fixing and Mark has had absolutely no more contact with Mr. Nakawara. Agent Shepard tries explaining to Mark that even though ADM may have already ceased these illegal activities, that does not change the fact that a crime had already been committed, so the FBI will still need to continue on with their investigation.
Yeah, note to everyone, if you go to the FBI claiming a crime has been committed, you can't just simply redact that statement 2 months later because you changed your mind.
This new information frustrates and flabbergasts Mark, but moments later after the call has ended, Mark walks just a few feet away to an awaiting German businessman where he and Mark immediately have a meeting that involves price fixing. As time progresses, Agent Shepard and his partner persistently make numerous attempts to meet with Mark in person, only to have Mark cancel each meeting unexpectedly at the last minute. When the FBI is finally able to make contact with Mark, Mark voices his concern that ADM had just recently given him a $100,000 raise, and Mark is now worried that the FBI may end up costing him his job. He really did not think this through very much, did he? Mark then agrees to subject himself to the FBI's lie detector test, which he ends up failing tremendously, despite Mark's belief that he had actually done pretty well for himself.
Yeah, in the book, it talks about how he was, like, watching the little spindles that, you know, record responses, and he was convinced he did well, but he gets two polygraphs over the course of this investigation, and both of them are just the worst fails one could imagine.
There is that scene in the movie where he is taking the polygraph test and he is watching the little line on the piece of paper go up and down and it's just kind of staying steady. And he believes he did well because the line doesn't move very much. That's his logic behind believing that. And the FBI have to explain to him after that he does not know how to read a lie detector test. Agent Shepard and his partner plead with Mark to just tell them the truth on record for the sake of him and his family, and begin questioning Mark again regarding all of the information he had previously given them. It is at this point that Mark finally confesses to having made up the alleged mole working at ADM. Mark also confesses that the price fixing at ADM not only hasn't stopped, but actually involves much more than just lysine. When we next see Mark back at ADM, he is wearing a wire and narrating his entire morning to the FBI as we listen in. This is like, I am approaching the building. I am now opening the door to the building. I am passing Molly in the hallway. Molly is the administrative assistant for Mr. Connors. Just literally useless information nonstop. He just can't stop talking. Much to the frustration to the FBI listening in.
I guess if you are nervous and want to make sure that you're giving useful information because you've been chastised for not doing so for months, you could kind of see why he's like, all right, I'm now going to be very upfront and open about everything that I'm doing, because they can't see what he's doing. They can only hear the conversations, but he doesn't realize, like, they don't give a shit that he's opening the door. They assume if he's wearing the wire and talking to an executive that he's at work and has gone through the door and walked through these hallways.
It seems like he means well, but it's a bit misguided. For the next few months, ADM sends Mark around the world on several business trips with the president of ADM, Terry Wilson, played by Rick Overton, all while Mark continues to wear a wire. With these new recordings and Mark's cooperation, Agent Shepard and his partner seem quite pleased with the intel they've been able to gather thus far, but still feel that they need to improve the audio quality of the recordings. When Mark finally returns home one day from one of his many business trips, he decides to casually show off the FBI recording device he had installed in his briefcase to his family's landscaper, then brags about being a secret agent. His codename? 0014, because it's twice as smart as 007.
Ba-dum-bum.
During his next meeting, Mark and two of his other associates from ADM discuss business with some of their Japanese partners from Ajinomoto in Irvine, California, in a hotel boardroom that is being recorded using both audio and video surveillance by the FBI. Unfortunately, when Agent Shepard and his partner bring the tapes back to their superiors at FBI headquarters for review, they're told that the information contained on the tapes is far too vague to prosecute in the eyes of the Justice Department.
So in this tape, there was a lot of information revealed about price fixing, but what the prosecution saw as the biggest problem was Whitaker was doing most of the talking while the other individuals involved in the meeting were just kind of agreeing with him. And they said he didn't use like specific enough terms that would limit any confusion or doubt by a potential jury in the future.
So, Agent Shepard and his partner meet with Mark yet again, where they plan for Mark to schedule an additional meeting with ADM and Ajinomoto to discuss price fixing much more directly. And since the FBI are not allowed to monitor any business taking place in Japan, Mark has the bright idea to hold the additional meeting in Hawaii this time instead.
So in actuality, they encouraged Mark to try to get people to come to Hawaii. He does go to Japan. I don't know if they show this in the movie. Since they can't get permission from Japan to let the FBI tape, they suggest to Mark that he could tape if he bought his own recordings. They don't force him to do this, but they're like, it'd be nice if you would.
That is not in the film, actually. The whole Hawaii thing comes off as directly Mark's idea to get a nice trip to Hawaii.
Yeah, they tell him to try to encourage a meeting in the States. And I think it is Mark's idea for Hawaii because he knows all these executives like golf and there's apparently good golf in Hawaii.
Cut to Mark and his partners at ADM playing a round of golf amidst the lush greens of America's 50th state. They are also being monitored from afar by federal agents. After ADM and Ajinomoto have finished hitting the green, they retreat back to one of their hotel rooms to discuss their business further. This room is also, of course, being monitored by the FBI, and this time they are able to properly record evidence of ADM and Ajinomoto coming to an agreement regarding price fixing. After this, Agent Shepard and his partner return back to FBI headquarters to review the new tapes with their superiors, while Mark goes on about his business, still firmly under the belief that once this has all been settled, Mark will somehow be declared president of ADM, because everyone else will be in jail. Mark's wife Ginger is not quite so delusional and refers to Mark's plan as completely illogical, and I would agree with her.
Ginger is a saint.
She sticks by him throughout all of this. Somehow, she stands by her man through thick and thin.
Yeah, they're still married to this day.
On June 27th, 1995, Agent Shepard, along with several other FBI agents, have a confidential meeting with Mark in a local motel room where they go over with him exactly what will happen when ADM is raided the following morning. Agent Shepard also advises Mark to get his own attorney after, but to in no way accept any offer from ADM to provide an attorney for him, as they are primarily paid to represent the company's best interests and not Mark's. The next day, ADM is raided by the FBI. Several of Mark's business associates are indicted at their homes, while the president of ADM and Mark are both indicted at a restaurant while out to a company business dinner. That same night, Mark, Terry, and Mick hold an emergency meeting outside Mick's home where they all unanimously agree to let the company lawyers handle everything. Back with the FBI, they receive a phone call from another agent involved in the ADM raid who informs them that one of the ADM employees who had just been indicted that evening had already been tipped off by Mark days in advance that the raid was coming. This new information perturbs the FBI, to say the least. So later that same night, Agent Shepard and his partner meet up with Mark again in a parking lot and ask Mark directly who else he had informed about the raid in advance. Mark then reluctantly admits that he had informed his secretary months ago that he had secretly been working with the FBI and about the impending raid, along with his friend Schmitty. The next day, Mark meets with the lawyers from ADM, despite Agent Shepard's previous warning, and agrees to answer a few questions. This meeting ends up lasting well into the evening as Mark seemingly spills the beans about everything to the lawyer from ADM. After the meeting has concluded, Mark and ADM's attorney reconvene with Mark's other business associates, where Mark informs them that he will be cooperating with the FBI in their investigation.
So, fun fact, after he spilled the beans to this attorney, the attorney is like silent. And Mark either asks if he should get a different attorney, and that attorney agrees, or the attorney suggests it. So even this attorney is like, why did you just tell me all of this?
That happens right after, actually. Mark is talking to the other business associates from ADM and tells them that ADM's attorney has advised him to seek out alternative legal representation. And ADM's attorney just nods profusely and goes, oh, yes, yes, we think that's a very good idea.
So that's good for that attorney because they did not have to do that. They're not representing Whitaker in any way. They're representing the company. That's kind of going a little bit above and beyond the duties. It is the ethical thing to do. So I'm glad that they made that decision. And I guess that is what convinced Whitaker, since he didn't listen to the two FBI agents that he had at this time grown very close to.
They had been working together for several years at this point. So Mark goes off and finds himself his own lawyer named James Epstein, played by Arrested Development alum Tony Hale. As Mark repeats his story for his new attorney, Mark states that he had recorded over 200 tapes for the FBI while acting as their informant for the past 2.5 years. Mark's attorney then emphasizes that Mark should under no circumstances discuss any of this information with anyone else moving forward. Cut to Mark eating a big bowl of cereal in his home, explaining to the FBI over the telephone as to why he had just recently given an interview to the Wall Street Journal. Mark's attorney finds out about this interview while taking the train to work that morning and reading it in the newspaper along with several other passengers sitting around him.
This attorney gets put through the ringer by his client.
Tony Hale does not have a lot to work with in this role, but he has a wonderful bugged-out-eyed expression that comes across his face during various parts where Mark is just confessing so many things, and it's very subtle, but very, very good. Tony Hale is hilarious. This whole film is filled with a lot of comedians who are not technically doing anything funny, but they're still able to bring the comedy through just their reactions to Mark, really. After that initial interview, various news reporters begin to gather outside of Mark's home, but for the first time ever, Mark refuses to answer any more questions. Agent Shepard and his partner also pay Mark's wife Ginger a visit around this time to strongly reiterate that her husband absolutely needs to stop talking to everyone. Cut to Mark giving yet another detailed interview in a random hotel room where Mark even gets his picture taken for the story. Meanwhile, back at ADM, Mark's former colleagues have just discovered a forged photocopied signature on some of Mark's old business documents. We then return back to Mark, who is currently eating lunch with Agent Shepard and his partner, as the two agents repeatedly discourage Mark from disclosing any more information, literally telling Mark point blank, do not tell us any more information. Then, through a long series of hypotheticals, Mark somehow admits to taking in nearly $500,000 in various kickbacks while working as an executive at ADM starting back in December of 1991. Some of which may have even occurred while Mark was working as an informant for the FBI. The attorneys from ADM then arrange a meeting with the FBI where they disclose recently discovered evidence of Mark depositing $2.5 million into a Swiss bank account while Mark was in Switzerland on business for ADM. ADM's attorneys also have a sworn testimony from an executive at another company stating that their signature was forged on several documents and that their company had never done business or ever received any sort of check from ADM. ADM's attorneys are now arguing that Mark plotted against his coworkers, lied about the lysine, and had secretly planned to take over the company from the very beginning.
So they're essentially saying that that original phone call about the saboteur at the plant was completely fake, which Mark actually does admit to way, way, way back in the day, but he continued to believe or assert that he believed there was still sabotage going on. But now ADM thinks that that was all just another plan for him to try to embezzle more money from ADM.
ADM also knows about the kickbacks Mark took while working as an informant for the FBI, and now alleges that the agency was well aware of Mark's illegal activities, but chose to ignore them in order to focus on the price fixing at ADM instead.
Which is a big accusation to make against the federal government.
Back at FBI headquarters, everyone is now freaking the fuck out. It is then decided that no one from the FBI will be allowed to speak with Mark about the case under any circumstances, effective immediately. We then cut back to Mark at his attorney's office, where his attorneys are also, understandably, freaking the fuck out. Mark's attorneys then arrange a meeting with the FBI, where they are told quite bluntly by the agency that Mark is no longer considered a cooperating witness for the FBI. The FBI then begins to question Mark about his criminal conduct at ADM, and Mark answers every question with little to no hesitation. Mark even gives the name of the person who first taught him how to use embezzlements and kickbacks in order to make tax-free money back in 1992. Continuing on without basically any provocation, Mark's attorneys look on aghast as their client nonchalantly confesses to various criminal activities. Mark even admits at one point that he knew that the fraud he had perpetrated was wrong and he wanted to accept full responsibility for his actions. It is at this point, when the FBI drops the bomb, that they now have several copies of fraudulent checks Mark had forged, which had been submitted to the agency earlier by the attorneys over at ADM. It's not looking great for old Mark at this point.
And it's about to get a lot worse.
Mark and his wife Ginger then start scheduling sessions with a psychologist, and through their conversations, we learn from Ginger that Mark had purchased 8 cars in the past few years, which Ginger did find rather suspicious in retrospect. We also learn that Mark still hasn't informed his attorneys about several other foreign bank accounts Mark has various parts of his money stashed away in, and the psychologist begins to theorize that Mark may actually be bipolar. Mark responds to this theory by telling the tale of when both of his parents had died in a car accident when he was a young boy, resulting in Mark being adopted by a wealthy man who owned a successful amusement park. When Mark and his attorneys next meet with the FBI, Mark's attorney is now offering his clients full cooperation. Mark then immediately begins to confess that certain aspects of his previous confession were not entirely accurate and starts giving out more names of other people who had been involved in assisting Mark with his embezzlements. In a sort of montage of information, we also learn that Mark had made up a fake business that ADM had written over $200,000 in checks to that would eventually end up in one of Mark's many accounts. We also find out that Mark even managed to pull off the Nigerian Prince scam at one point. And if you've never heard of the Nigerian Prince scam, it involves a scammer promising someone a significant share of a large sum of money in return for a small upfront payment, which the scammer claims will then be used to obtain the large sum of money. Then, if the person takes the bait and actually makes the payment requested, the scammer will usually just vanish without a trace after.
We all get those emails, or at least I do now several times a day, of these people saying, "Oh, I've come into millions of dollars. I need your bank account information, and then you'll get a huge cut." And while we know, most of us know, that this is all a scam now, as we're getting them in emails, I guess back in the day they would come through faxes, and a lot of people fell for it apparently, so I guess that explains why it continues to this day.
I do remember getting these emails from time to time. Years ago, I haven't gotten a Nigerian Prince email in quite a long time, thankfully, but they were a really common scam that I remember happening in the 90s and early 2000s.
I still get them to this day. All the time to my work email. It is so obnoxious.
In the end, Mark estimates that he made a grand total of around $7.7 million from his various illegal activities. On his way home one day, Mark stops momentarily to rip the sleeve of his jacket and tousle his hair a bit before bursting through the front door of his home with a fake limp, calling out to his wife Ginger that he had just been kidnapped. The following day, Mark partakes in a network interview to describe his fictitious experience. The next time Mark meets with his attorneys, Mark is informed that he has been offered a plea deal and would only need to serve 3 to 5 years for his crimes. Mark counters this offer by telling his attorney that he would prefer to file a lawsuit against both the FBI and the United States government. Mark's attorney pleads with Mark to just take the damn deal already, but Mark, as always, refuses to listen and decides to find himself a new lawyer instead. Meanwhile, in Ravenna, Ohio, Mark's parents, both still alive and well, receive a phone call inquiring as to if they had ever in fact died in any sort of car accident, to which Mark's mother humbly responds, "No." The FBI next have a meeting with Mark's new attorney, who is dressed in a Hawaiian print polo shirt and specializes in personal injury law. Mark's new attorney claims that Special Agent Shepard had at one point struck Mark with a briefcase while Mark had been cooperating with the government. Mark's new attorney also presents a letter from Mark's psychologist stating that the FBI forced Mark into a bipolar situation, and from a medical standpoint, that is the equivalent of attempted murder.
That's absurd.
It is extremely absurd. The FBI then quickly confirmed that the letter itself is also a forgery and yet another lie from Mark. When Mark is confronted with this information at his home by Agent Shepard, it is the first time where Mark simply cannot think of any more excuses. Flash forward to October 1997, where the trial of the United States government versus Mark Whitaker is coming to a close. The judge asks Mark if he would like to say anything before the verdict is read, and Mark does meanderingly apologize and accepts responsibility for his actions. Side note here, the speech Mark makes in the courtroom scene is taken from the actual transcript from the trial, with the twist that Damon was instructed by Soderbergh to act out the scene as if he were accepting an award.
Oh, that was probably fun to watch.
It is great. Matt Damon does a wonderful job in this movie. I really do think this is one of his best performances. October 2002. Mark, now looking much older and wearing a beige prison jumpsuit, is recording a video requesting a pardon from the President of the United States while referencing the unfairness of Mark's 9-year sentence. Mark also admits on camera that Agent Shepard never hit Mark with a briefcase like he had previously claimed, and also indirectly blames ADM yet again for forcing him to lie about it. Mark then casually mentions that he has obtained several degrees while serving out his time in prison, and nonchalantly attempts to take credit for the US government collecting over $1 billion in price fixing from big businesses since his imprisonment.
I do want to point out that even though he put the FBI through the ringer, they fully supported this pardon, including the agent he accused of misconduct.
That is interesting. That is not portrayed in the film, because I'm guessing it would lessen the comedic effect.
It wasn't even the FBI. The prosecution and the judge wrote letters supporting his pardon, as well as the executive of ADM who took over once all of this shit hit the fan.
You are making me very intrigued about this true story. There's a lot of little things that I can tell was left out here. After Mark has refinished recording his video and is just about to be escorted back to his prison cell, Mark offhandedly mentions to FBI Special Agent Herndon that he may have stolen $11.5 million instead of the $9.5 million previously believed. When Agent Herndon asks Mark for further clarification on this, Mark just shrugs and says he can't remember. As the film comes to a close, we get the following updates. An investigation by the FBI, the IRS, and ADM determined that all disputed funds were accounted for. Whitaker ultimately admitted that the embezzlement idea was his alone. ADM paid over $500 million in civil settlements and government penalties. They are currently under new management. Mick Andreas and Terry Wilson served 3 years in prison and were released in 2002. We then cut to Edgefield, South Carolina, on December of 2006, where Mark has just been released from prison to find his loyal wife Ginger outside waiting for him. The screen then reads, Mark Whitaker is currently COO and President of Operations of Cypress Systems Incorporated. He has not been granted a presidential pardon. And that was the film The Informant, Ashley. What do you think?
What a wild ride.
It is nuts. There were so many times when I was writing this story that I had to go back, double check names, double check dates, information. This story just keeps changing as it progresses, making you have to kind of go back and look at things differently. And I really like this movie. I think this is a really good film, but whether or not it holds a candle to the real life story, we will soon find out. But let's find out what happened after this film came out. The film currently holds a 79% approval rating on Rotten Tomatoes, with a critical consensus that reads, a charismatic turn by star Matt Damon and a consistently ironic tone boost this quietly funny satire about a corporate whistleblower.
I do find it fascinating how they portrayed the kind of mania or hypomania of this character through the internal dialogue, through how they made him look and act. And it sounds like it came across well in the movie.
I think it came across tremendously, but I do not know anything about the real Mark. I haven't even seen a picture. I haven't heard any interviews. And I know Damon did not base his performance on the real person. So perhaps my opinion will change a bit once I find out the true story behind this. To promote the film, the studio sent out buckets of corn that were not fit for human consumption, which I just found kind of funny. The film got multiple award nominations, including a Satellite Award for Best Actor in a Motion Picture, Musical or Comedy, for Matt Damon, as well as a nomination from the Detroit Film Critics Society. Damon was also nominated for the Golden Globe Award for Best Performance by an Actor in a Motion Picture, Musical or Comedy. After the film had been completed, the director Steven Soderbergh held a private screening for Mark and his wife Ginger, and claimed that Mark even told him that he liked the film. If Mark was telling the truth, of course. And that is Steven Soderbergh's The Informant. Quite the tangled web tale, don't you agree?
I do, and this is, I always say this. Well, more often than not, I guess I say it, for the movies we covered that I haven't watched, that it is one I do want to watch. So now I think, Remy, since we've recorded enough episodes at this point, you're going to be watching some of these again. This is going to be one.
We are going to have to do a movie marathon where we watch all the films from the podcast that I have had the pleasure of seeing, but you have not yet. And maybe we'll do another podcast where you can tell us how you feel now seeing the film versions.
Well, with that being said, is it that time to talk about the true story behind Steven Soderbergh's The Informant?
It most certainly is, Ashley.
All right, quick caveat here before we start. I mentioned this earlier, but the source material for this book and movie is incredibly long, incredibly detailed. The book itself is over 600 pages, and there is a 5-page list of the main characters involved in the story.
She showed me this list. It is crazy how many characters this true story has.
So for the purpose of time, I had to condense a lot of information. That's why I was kind of jumping in more often than I typically do, Remy, while you were sharing the movie version, because a lot of what I shared is stuff I had omitted from my part. Otherwise, there would have been no way I would have been able to condense my outline to 10 pages.
You are welcome to jump in with new information anytime I am talking, Ashley.
So because a lot of information is condensed, if you're interested in learning more about the case, I highly recommend reading the book The Informant, The True Story of a Tattletale. It is very well written, and I don't see how it couldn't include everything you would want to know about this case. It was published before Whitaker was released from prison, so all of that stuff is omitted, but that's a very, very small portion of the story. By the 1980s, ADM had transformed itself into a global processing plant. The company produced various ingredients, such as lysine, citric acid, and MSG, that are in nearly every single product typical Americans use. Think everything from the food we eat to the laundry detergent we use.
I believe it's even in some garbage bags as well.
Their products are in literally everything. They also are used in farm staples that are utilized by both small and large operations. The price-fixing case was not the first time ADM attracted government attention. The chief executive and primary chairman of ADM, Duane Andres, secretly gave funds to the Nixon administration throughout the 70s, which in turn resulted in federal agricultural policies that directly benefited the company. ADM pled no contest to price fixing in 1978 and pulled out of an investigation involving illegal trading in the mid-80s, which created a turbulent relationship with the FBI. This relationship worsened in 1991 after ADM and the FBI discovered a former treasurer had engaged in irregular financial practices, causing the company to lose $14 million. Despite these losses, ADM did not cooperate with the investigation, and the treasurer did not face any legal consequences. In September 1992, employees from a Japanese rival company visited ADM to tour the plant. At that time, ADM was focused on expanding their production of lysine, but recurrent viral contamination was resulting in huge production losses. A few weeks after this visit, 35-year-old Mark Whitaker, president of the bioproducts division, which was responsible for lysine production, shared information he claimed to have recently learned from an executive who toured the plant weeks prior. Whitaker claimed the caller knew the Japanese competitor used an undercover operative to sabotage ADM's lysine production efforts by injecting viruses into the batches. The caller allegedly requested $10 million in exchange for information about the saboteur's identity, details about exactly how the contamination was carried out, and a virus immunization organism. FBI agent Brian Shepard was assigned the espionage and extortion case in November 1992. While meeting with ADM executives, it was shared that the anonymous source had reduced the asking price to $6 million. ADM and the FBI decided that Whitaker would have the work line at his house bugged by the FBI, contact the anonymous source, and agree to turn over the money in two increments, with the second meeting occurring in person so the FBI could arrest the extortionist. However, when Shepard turned up to tap the line 2 days later, Whitaker expressed some hesitancy about proceeding and claimed to have intimate knowledge about ADM's shady business practices. Over the course of several hours, Whitaker disclosed information about how ADM was involved in price-fixing meetings with other lysine distributors in Japan and Korea. While he admitted to recently becoming involved in these meetings, he said he was only doing so under the direction of his superiors and was worried he would be blamed if the practices were discovered.
So there never was any mixing up of the phone lines like there was in the film. They were going to tap his line, and then Mark came forward with this information before they were even able to tap his line?
They don't end up tapping his line here yet. I think they come back and then do it in a few days. But he did kind of vacillate between saying these calls were happening on my business line versus house line. So that part is pretty true.
They just made him look a little sillier in the film version.
He also shared information about other potential crimes, such as ADM stealing microbes from other companies and using sex workers to obtain secret information from their competitors.
What? This was not in the movie.
Yeah, and these two claims actually do end up being true. So way down the line, which I can't remember if I include, but they do obtain various sources that confirm this sex worker claim, and they even obtain like a list of questions that these sex workers were supposed to ask the businessmen who they were servicing.
I love how this story is just so crazy and all over the place that they couldn't even fit that into the film version.
It's really funny. The list was titled Questions for the Girls or something like ridiculous like that.
I wish we could get a copy of that list. I am curious what the questions that they were supposed to ask were.
There are several questions in the book, and they were like questions that a sex worker or anyone engaging in intimate practices would not ask, like very detailed business questions. They were ridiculous. A few days later, Whitaker gave Shepherd more information about ADM's involvement in price fixing. This included details about what was discussed during the meetings and his suspicions that it was done in other product divisions as well. He agreed to start wearing a wire and be an FBI informant. Throughout the course of the investigation, prosecutors routinely wondered why Whitaker was risking so much to blow the whistle on ADM. He repeatedly claimed that he wanted to cooperate because he knew price fixing was illegal and believed ADM would see that he did the right thing and thus promote him to president of the company once the illegal dealings were brought to light.
So he had this ridiculous belief very early on.
Yeah, he was just really convinced that the shareholders and board members of this company that would then owe millions of dollars to the government would be like, well, at least we had an honest employee.
Businesses care so much about honesty.
And nothing about profits. Whitaker was a wild card during the rest of 1992. He vacillated between wanting to cooperate with the FBI and retracting his claims of corporate wrongdoing. He also did not tape any meetings or phone calls as promised. Unbeknownst to the FBI, he also instructed one of his VPs to sell more lysine products than agreed upon during price-fixing meetings. His goal was to flood the market and damage ADM's relationship with competitors, a strategy he thought would get him out of needing to talk to the FBI because then these price-fixing negotiations would stop because no one else would trust ADM. As the FBI's frustration with Whitaker mounted, they had him submit to a polygraph, which revealed concerns about deception about the espionage claims. Whitaker then admitted to lying about that saboteur call, but he still suspected espionage was occurring. He soon signed a cooperation agreement, which stated he would not be prosecuted based on any information he provided during the price-fixing investigation, as long as he didn't conceal or lie about anything he did or learned, did not tell anyone about the investigation, and most importantly, did not engage in criminal activity without FBI approval. Whitaker took another polygraph in March 1993, as he had yet to produce any new information about price fixing, and the tapes he did turn over were essentially useless. This time, the questions, which also revealed concerns about deception, were about if he was being deceptive about his involvement with price fixing. He continued to assert he was being truthful, but he did start recording phone calls and meetings with more regularity. The FBI placed surveillance equipment in a Chicago hotel room to record a price-fixing meeting with the Japanese competitor the next month. Whitaker also recorded conversations with Terry Wilson, president of another ADM division, in which Wilson talked about fixing prices for citric acid. Meanwhile, Whitaker's wife Ginger started having concerns about her husband's stress and lack of sleep, which she attributed to his dual roles with ADM and the FBI, which I think is fair. This would be extremely stressful.
I couldn't imagine. I'd be having panic attacks just about every single day if I was Mark in this situation.
Yeah, there's no way I would be able to just stroll into the office every day just acting like my normal self. I'd be freaked out and so paranoid.
I am a terrible liar. I could never be an FBI informant. Everyone would know that something was wrong immediately.
So if any of our employers are listening, they now know for certain that we are not FBI informants. We would not be able to conceal this from you for very long. Although Whitaker routinely taped calls by summer of 1993, the FBI had a hard time convincing other countries to allow them to record discussions during price-fixing meetings. Meanwhile, prices of lysine continued to rise, and Whitaker estimated the company was making millions and even a billion more in extra profits from these price-fixing meetings. Whitaker tried to convince competitors to come to the States for a future meeting, but they cited America's harsh laws against the practice as the reason for their refusal, and that reasoning was caught on tape. a price-fixing meeting was finally scheduled in Los Angeles in October 1993. These recordings were a bombshell for the investigation now nicknamed Harvest King, which, if you guys don't know, all FBI investigations get really funny nicknames. We learned that when we watched the McMillions documentary about the McDonald's Monopoly thing on HBO.
I mean, if you can call an investigation whatever you want, why not think of something fun? It's more memorable.
Well, and they want to make sure that they give all of these investigations nicknames because they want to make sure if conversations are accidentally overheard, people don't know what they're talking about.
It's funny. In a lot of high-budget Hollywood blockbuster films, when they are in pre-production, the studio or the filmmakers or whoever, they will come up with a fake title that is kind of fun, like the FBI's case titles. But I remember for Star Wars, I believe it was called Blue Harvest. And for The Dark Knight, I believe it was Rory's First Kiss was the working title for The Dark Knight while they were filming.
What does that have to do with The Dark Knight?
Absolutely nothing.
Okay. Maybe they were a big fan of what? Wasn't Rory from Dawson's Creek?
Was Rory Katie?
I never watched Dawson's Creek, so I'm not sure.
I have to look up now if Katie Holmes played Rory on Dawson's Creek, because if that's the case, that's even more funny.
Oh, that's probably it. It was probably Katie Holmes.
She wasn't in The Dark Knight, so...
But she was in...
She was in Batman Begins, so maybe that was an inside thing about Katie Holmes. We may have to take all this out. I need to look up if Katie Holmes even played Rory on Dawson's Creek. I just looked it up, and Rory is from Gilmore Girls.
During that price-fixing meeting in October 1993, the FBI obtained recordings of the leasing companies setting production limits and sales values. Whitaker also recorded meetings in Japan and Hawaii, during which competitors negotiated their production allotments and talked about how they would share production numbers each month to ensure each company was abiding by the agreement. By April 2004, the FBI wanted to expand their investigation to include other product divisions, such as citric acid, but they knew it would be difficult without cooperation from another ADM executive, and they didn't want to risk approaching someone without being absolutely certain that they would agree to cooperate because it just would have blown their whole investigation. Although Whitaker continued to tape his interactions with high-level executives throughout 2004, he opted to not record or inform the FBI about a price-fixing meeting in Switzerland or one he had with his division in which he shared specific details about the lysine price-fixing process to the shock of his subordinates. Per his wife Ginger, Whitaker rarely slept or spent time with his family. He also displayed odd behavior, such as spending hours in the horse stables on the property and obsessively using his leaf blower even during thunderstorms. Whitaker recorded a price-fixing meeting in January 1995 in which new production levels and costs were negotiated. The Harvest King agents tried to warn Whitaker about the high possibility that he would be fired rather than promoted and viewed as a hero after the investigation wrapped, but he didn't seem open to even considering that as a possibility.
I would say there was more than a high possibility of that occurring.
And you know what? The Harvest King agents agreed. That next month, they argued that a financial package should be prepared for Whitaker in the event that he lost his job, a decision which was fully supported by the Springfield FBI headquarters.
So the FBI was looking out for him. They didn't want him to get fucked over in all this. They actually seemed like they had his best interests in mind. They were trying.
The Harvest King agents were trying to get this financial package to be as close per month as what he was making for his monthly salary. They really went to bat for this guy.
That is very respectable of the federal agents to do that.
Because they knew without his participation, none of this information about price fixing would have come to light.
I believe the FBI should take care of their informants when they are cooperating fully and being honest and not committing other crimes. But I do believe that, yeah, you should look after these people. They are helping.
Well, and earlier you had discussed how there were several points where the FBI was kind of barred from contacting Whitaker once this fraud stuff comes to light. And that did happen. And the Harvest King agents were really upset about this. They wanted to not talk to Whitaker about his crimes, but they saw that this man was mentally fragile and argued that cutting off communications was not fair because it would be viewed as the FBI abandoning their informants, which is something they claim they don't do unless absolutely necessary.
This is shown in the film. Agent Shepard and his partner do seem to genuinely care about Mark, and after the FBI makes that mandate that they're no longer able to speak to him about the case, they do still meet with him and go out to lunch with him, and it is during the scene where they strongly say, do not give us any information. They're literally just out to lunch with him that day. They weren't doing anything but checking in on him, making sure he was still doing all right with all this.
Yeah, and like you said, they had worked with him for years at this point. They had gotten to know him really, really well, and they cared about his well-being as well as the well-being of his wife and children. Raids of ADM were finally scheduled towards the end of June 1995. Whitaker was told to keep a low profile, as the raids would make it clear to ADM that someone cooperated. This advice was given to not only protect the investigation, but Whitaker himself. He was also instructed to not tell anyone about his prior involvement in the case, obtain independent legal counsel as ADM's lawyers would be representing the company and not him, and not tell the FBI anything he overheard about ADM's potential defense strategy. On the night of June 27th, the Harvest King agents started the evening by interviewing ADM's vice chairman Mick Andres, the son of president and head chairman Dwayne Andres, and division president Terry Wilson. The Harvest King agents told both men minimal details about the price-fixing investigation, even playing small snippets of some tapes that did not directly include Whitaker speaking. But both men said price-fixing was absolutely impossible and declined to comment further without counsel. While this was occurring, the FBI was fanning out across the city, issuing search warrants and seizing boxes of documents from the homes of many executives and the ADM office. Through individual interviews, three people said they knew about the raids for days to months, information they learned from Whitaker. One of the witnesses, Whitaker's secretary, said she had known Whitaker was an FBI informant for years. Whitaker acknowledged warning these people, claiming he trusted them and didn't want them to be afraid about cooperating with the investigation when the time came for them to do so. The FBI also spoke to Assistant Chairman Howard Buffett, son of billionaire investor Warren Buffett. He shared that Whitaker told him about the price-fixing investigation months ago, after he told Whitaker he was thinking about leaving ADM when he was chastised by Dwayne Andres for not violating political campaign donation laws. Although Buffett denied personal knowledge about price-fixing, he did know ADM misrepresented the size of their revenues to shareholders to inflate their stock prices. Although the FBI told Whitaker to get his own attorney and not speak to the lawyers hired by ADM, Whitaker did meet with a lawyer representing the company a day or two after the raid and told them detailed information about his involvement with the FBI and was shocked when his statements were disclosed to his superiors who put him on leave. He then retained Chicago attorney James Epstein. The first article about the investigation was published by the Wall Street Journal about a week after the raids. Whitaker participated in the interview, talking all about his role as an FBI informant and what he discovered, despite initially telling the FBI and his attorney that he declined to make a comment when he was contacted.
I still don't understand why he's doing all of this. It is just bonkers to me. I do not understand this man's thought process at all.
He comes across to me as someone who is extremely impulsive. He does get diagnosed with bipolar disorder, so kind of this reckless behavior, just kind of acting without consideration of the consequences, bizarre actions are associated with bipolar. They don't specify what, like, severity of bipolar disorder he has. It sounds to me like bipolar 2, which is this more hypomania. So people with bipolar 1, if you see, they're just it's very damaging mental illness. People with bipolar 2 are typically still able to function, even though they are kind of constantly in this elevated mood state. ADM also started getting anonymous letters and faxes from someone claiming to be part of a shareholders group. The writer claimed to have known about ADM's misconduct for years and to have had knowledge about lies told by Whitaker that could harm the FBI investigation. On the other hand, the letters also demanded the resignation of various executives and mentioned Whitaker as a potential replacement. The letters continued to flow in for years, and although a few of them, particularly towards the end, were traced back to Whitaker, it turns out that most did come from a prominent shareholder who had just been dissatisfied about plummeting stock prices, liked Whitaker, and wanted ADM to be managed differently.
That is shocking to me that it did not end up turning out to be Mark in the end.
Me too. I thought this whole time while they were talking about these like weird ass letters that were signed like Lamet Vav, which is some sort of secret society. I don't know. It's really weird. I thought for sure they were all from Mark because they were kind of described as like rambling and nonsensical and all of this stuff. But most of them were traced back to someone who actually was head of a shareholders group.
I think if they had actually turned out to be from Mark, it would have been included in the film. And this part was not in the film because it doesn't make Mark look foolish.
There was like two that they were able to trace back to Mark, but
for the most part, it was real people and not just Mark tooting his own horn and trying to help his situation.
Yeah, it was just some random dude that was part of the shareholders group. Meanwhile, Whitaker continued to do interviews with any magazine that would listen to him. He also threatened to sue ADM for slander because they said he was an untrustworthy employee. Whitaker asked to meet with the Harvest King agents, again, against Epstein's legal advice, in early August 1995. Although the agents urged Whitaker to not tell them anything about the investigation because his counsel told him not to, Whitaker, who started speaking in hypotheticals that were quickly dropped, shared that he and all other higher-ups at ADM accepted kickbacks of up to $500,000 for shady business deals and took steps to avoid paying taxes on this additional income since at least 1991.
I love that this was real and that the conversation began in him hypothetically telling them scenarios until he just ends up confessing. It's a great scene in the film, and I'm very pleasantly surprised to find out it's true.
Well, and he kind of starts out by saying, like, hypothetically, if a company gave an employee a car and that employee let his daughter drive said car, would that be illegal? And they're like, no, Mark. And he's like, okay. Hypothetically, if someone used a company plane for personal travel, would that be illegal? And they're like, I mean, no, that's unethical, but not illegal. And he's like, okay, hypothetically, now let's talk about these kickbacks. It was pretty darn clear that that's what he was getting at because he was saying these checks were deposited at like a dollar or two under the amount that would have required the banks to alert the government of them being deposited.
That is hilarious.
The next day, ADM's lawyers discovered evidence proving Whitaker submitted bogus contracts and invoices and forged the signature of the ADM president on a check for $2.5 million. The check was made payable to what would soon be determined to be a Switzerland shell company created by Whitaker. It was immediately clear that Whitaker violated the FBI cooperation agreement. ADM also accused the FBI of being complicit to these crimes, but refused to turn over the evidence they claimed supported this accusation. Spoiler alert, that allegation had no legs to stand on. It was basically from one of those random rambling faxes that said this happened. The accusations against Whitaker resulted in the development of another investigation separate from the price-fixing case that was then assigned to the fraud section of the Department of Justice, which I'm going to just abbreviate to DOJ from here on out. Again, even though his attorney strongly advised he not do this, Whitaker agreed to meet with the U.S. Attorney's Office in Chicago the same day it was announced that he was fired from ADM for embezzling at least $2.5 million. Right off the get-go, Whitaker was told the cooperation agreement was void because he engaged in criminal conduct without government permission. During the interview, he claimed Mick Andres taught him everything he knew about how to embezzle money from ADM and deposit kickbacks while evading U.S. tax laws. He described how he was paid hundreds of thousands of dollars from independent contractors he hired, cash checks from bogus contracts, and created a Swiss company to launder his illegally obtained funds. A few days later, Whitaker had three large checks mailed to his brother-in-law from one of his Swiss bank accounts. Mail had been forwarded there for several weeks as Ginger told her brother that ADM might be tampering with their mail. Whitaker was set to have a second interview with the DOJ on August 9, 1995. However, this meeting was canceled after he was found in his car following a suicide attempt by carbon monoxide poisoning. During a psychiatric evaluation, Whitaker displayed rapid and pressured speech and paranoia. He described how he started being much more reckless with his money 3 or 4 years ago, which is when he started opening offshore bank accounts, spending way more than his yearly salary would have allotted, purchasing all these expensive cars that most of them he didn't even drive, and used his briefcase to transport expensive jewelry and loads of cash into the country without paying duty. When asked what he would have done if he was approached and caught with thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars in cash just in his suitcase, he said, huh, just never really thought about it.
I enjoy Mark's naivete.
He was admitted to a psychiatric hospital for further evaluation. By the time he was released several weeks later, he was diagnosed with bipolar disorder and prescribed lithium, which is one of the most common medications for mania. Shortly after Whitaker was admitted to the psychiatric facility, the Washington Post ran an article detailing how Whitaker was not who he claimed to be. The most shocking of these allegations involved how Whitaker's claim about being orphaned at a young age and adopted by millionaires, which is something he had told virtually everyone in his life, probably except for Ginger since they were like high school sweethearts, was completely bogus.
He talks about why he started making up this lie in the film. I don't know if this is accurate or not, but he mentions that he heard somewhere along the line that people sympathize more with orphans. So it was a way for people to sympathize with him easier, according to the film.
I guess that would make sense. It's not in the book why he told this lie, but I mean, it would be a story that would set you apart from other people, but boy, is that a fucked up thing to do.
Does the book mention if the fake millionaire that Mark was adopted by was an amusement park owner?
Yes, that is.
That's unbelievable.
2 weeks later, the amount of money he was estimated to have embezzled rose from $2 million, $2.5 million, to $9 million. Whitaker returned to Chicago for another federal interview after he was released from the hospital in September 1995. He admitted to making false statements and withholding information during the last interview. Although he continued to assert that ADM taught him about accepting kickbacks as it was a widespread practice, he did say he was not truthful with his superiors about how much he was taking because he knew they would have told him it was excessive. He estimated embezzling and evading taxes for $7.7 million through these so-called kickbacks, fake loan agreements, and fraudulent invoices, money in which he deposited in bank accounts in Switzerland and the Cayman Islands. Those are kind of two places that are known for people to put their money in when they don't want the feds to know about it or have access to it.
Criminals in films are always talking about their Swiss bank accounts.
And Cayman Islands. He said the largest amount of money, $3.75 million, was taken right as the price-fixing investigation was drawing to a close. He also implicated a bunch of other people, some of whom were his former employees, throughout his confession. Obviously, all of these men were contacted and interviewed. The first person to be interviewed by the FBI was Sid Hulse. Hulse was the VP of ADM's bioproducts division and Whitaker's best friend at ADM. He was the person that Whitaker called back in 1992 and encouraged to try to increase production of lysine to stop price fixing. Whitaker met Hulse while they were both employed at another agricultural company in the early 80s. Although Hulse started his ADM career as a lysine salesman, Whitaker soon told him how ADM was going to authorize bonuses to be paid outside of his normal checks. Hulse thought this was odd, But Whitaker assured him it was common practice for the company. Things got much more serious in 1991 when Hulse was instructed to set up a shell company so he could receive a $300,000 invoice from ADM, one-third of which Whitaker said belonged to him. Why did Hulse agree to do all this, and where did all this money go? Well, it was stolen by Nigerian scammers. Both Whitaker and Hulse lost nearly all of their money to this scheme. Thus, the initial creation of these shell companies, fake invoices, and storing money in offshore accounts did seem to have been done to help Whitaker recoup his losses. The FBI's next major interview was with Ron Ferrari, a former San Francisco's 49ers linebacker. This is a side note here, but during his interviews with the FBI, I don't know if this is true, but he shared that while he was in the NFL, there would be people that would accept bribes to essentially put themselves in a situation where they would just hit really hard against other players. That has nothing to do with the story. I just thought it was interesting. He also told the FBI that he was urged by Whitaker to create another fake company that was then used to embezzle millions from ADM. Reinhard Richter, president of ADM Mexico, was the next major player to be interviewed. He said Whitaker hired him as the lysine distributor for Mexico in 1991, which came with a $200,000 annual salary and a $50,000 signing bonus, the latter of which was paid off the books. At first, Richter tried to feign innocence, but after a taped voicemail proved he had more knowledge than he was letting on, he admitted to recent coaching from Whitaker. The FBI would later learn of at least two more attempts at witness tampering by the disgraced informant, which is a big, big no-no. Most of Richter's story was in line with Hulse's, including information about the Nigerian scheme. Another VP for ADM's bioproducts division was interviewed in February 1996. He was a fantastic witness and provided valuable information about price fixing. He also supported other claims Whitaker made about ADM's shady business practices, such as theft of microbes and using sex workers to obtain information from competitors. While all these investigations were happening throughout the first half of 1996, Whitaker continued to give frequent press interviews, faked a 20-minute abduction, and withdrew about $100,000 from a then-undiscovered Swiss bank account. The FBI was also interviewing executives from ADM's foreign lysine competitors during this time. By June 1996, two of those companies agreed to plead guilty, turn over all notes and information they had about price fixing, and pay a $10 million fine. A third and much smaller company was fined $75,000. All this information, in addition to what was learned from Marty Allison's testimony, Whitaker was no longer needed as a witness for the price fixing case, which was obviously great news for the government since he was clearly unreliable. Whitaker met with his lawyer in August 1996. In addition to being listed as a defendant in the price-fixing case, he was now facing 31 felony charges for conspiracy, wire fraud, money laundering, and filing false tax returns. The following month, Marty Allison agreed to meet with the fraud team in hopes of receiving a lenient sentence. He was again an outstanding witness. His confession included details about how Whitaker's financial misdeeds started after he bought into the Nigerian fraud scheme, how Whitaker convinced his two VPs, Allison and Hulse, to do the same, and lost everything in 1991. For the next 3 years, Allison accepted hundreds of thousands of dollars in fake ADM bonuses, most of which was ultimately given back to Whitaker under the guise of a loan to avoid paying taxes. Well, it seemed that Whitaker's fraudulent practice started for him to recoup losses from the Nigerian scheme. Greed seemed to be the primary reason he continued. ADM filed suit against Whitaker around the same time the FBI conducted this last interview with Allison. While reviewing the documents associated with this civil suit, the FBI learned about David Page, an individual Whitaker hired at $120,000 per year, plus a $30,000 signing bonus in June 1993. His only task was to give Whitaker one-third of his salary each month. He had no other duties as an ADM employee. Whitaker's attorney met with federal prosecutors in October 1996 to try to negotiate a favorable plea deal. During this negotiation meeting, Epstein stressed how the FBI would have never known about ADM's price fixing if it wasn't for Whitaker, which in turn would save the federal government and consumers substantially more than what was stolen by Whitaker. Whitaker was outraged when he found out about this meeting. He threatened to sue the government, claimed the FBI treated him poorly throughout the investigation, fired Epstein, and hired two attorneys with little to no experience with fraud or embezzlement cases, much less ones that were as serious as his. His belief that he was about to become the next ADM president also resurfaced and was at the forefront of his mind. He made all these choices while he was not on lithium because he liked how he felt when he wasn't taking it. Unfortunately, it's common for people to stop taking psychotropic medications once they start to feel better. Some of the commonly cited reasons are they think they are cured and no longer need the drug, they dislike the side effects, or they enjoy the euphoria of elevated mood states when they're not on their medication. By the end of 1996, Mick Andres, Terry Wilson, Mark Whitaker, and the president of a Japanese competitor were all charged with violating federal laws related to price fixing. Within the first 2 weeks of 1997, Whitaker was also indicted for 45 felonies related to fraud, tax evasion, money laundering, and obstruction of justice, the latter of which was related to witness tampering. It took a few days for Whitaker to learn about this indictment as he was back in a hospital getting treatment for mania. By the fall of 1997, the FBI had not recovered any evidence supporting Whitaker's claim that other ADM executives embezzled money or accepted kickbacks. Three of the people who provided evidence against Whitaker took plea deals to avoid jail time. Whitaker struck a tentative plea deal in which he would plead guilty to 37 felonies in exchange for 7 years in prison. Although he was urged to consider a global plea that would result in him combining this plea with the price-fixing case, he for some reason didn't want to do that. And it's something that the judge and the prosecution are like, why? I should also point out that there was a stipulation to this plea agreement. Whitaker had to tell the federal government everything he knew about price-fixing, including how he committed all these frauds and involvement of co-conspirators. He violated the conditions of this plea 1 month later, as it became quite clear to prosecution that he was trying to protect his BFF Hulse.
Oh, Mark.
He also doubled down on allegations he started making several months prior about the Harvest King agents conspiring against him, treating him poorly, assaulting him, and not allowing him to meet with a psychiatrist throughout the price-fixing investigation. His quote-unquote proof involved obviously forged documents and recordings of conversations he had with the Harvest King agents that were clearly spliced together.
That was not in the film, but should have been. So he was literally cutting together conversations to have it support what he was saying.
Yeah, he started recording his meetings with them pretty early on and would take these recordings and just mix and match them, but it was obvious that he had done this once you listened to them. On March 4th, 1998, a federal judge rejected the terms of Whitaker's plea bargain due to his dishonesty about Hulse's involvement in the fraud scheme and mistreatment from the Harvest King agents. He was sentenced to 9 years in federal prison and ordered to pay ADM $11 million in restitution. And that's just for the fraud stuff. So the price-fixing trial started 4 months later. Whitaker opted not to attend, again, against advice from counsel and the judge, as it would involve him being transferred to a maximum security prison throughout the duration of the trial. Instead, he wanted to remain in his minimum facility where the food was better and he felt safer. Andres, Wilson, and Whitaker were all convicted of price-fixing and sentenced to 2 years in prison. The Japanese competitor avoided the conviction as he just didn't return to the U.S. to face prosecution, which, smart. The feds also uncovered price fixing in the citric acid division, which resulted in additional fines and convictions. When all was said and done, the amount of fines owed to the federal government was over $1 billion. During prison interviews with the author of The Informant, Whitaker finally provided a full confession. He claimed he started embezzling money because he heard rumors about other executives doing so without legal ramifications. He claimed that he ramped up the amount of money he was taking after it became clear that the price-fixing investigation was coming to a close, as he wanted to make sure he was financially stable. He denied that the Nigerian fraud scheme was the reason he started embezzling money, saying he would have done so even if that hadn't occurred. He also denied that the falsified saboteur call requesting $10 million was another attempt by him to get a large payout. Whitaker's wife and children relocated to a home closer to the prison where he served his time and visited him every weekend throughout his incarceration. He also continued to pursue his education, earning additional advanced degrees on top of the several he already had. He was released from prison in December 2006. The next day, he started working for Cypress Systems and was promoted to COO and President of Operations in 2008, positions he continues to hold to this day. His work also involves researching cancer prevention, HIV, childhood malnutrition, and examining the relationship between prenatal nutrition and autism. He is the highest level executive of a Fortune 500 company to become a whistleblower. And that is the true story behind Steven Soderbergh's The Informant.
That is everything that I was hoping it would be and more. I am astounded how closely the film follows the real story and somehow omits other crazy things that Mark did. It is a fascinating story about crimes that I really knew little to nothing about going into this. And I think it's a pretty accurate representation of the story. I was laughing throughout the entire time you were telling the true story. And as far as I know, the book is not supposed to be a comedy. It is just a straight-told story, correct?
Yeah, it's just written like a nonfiction research book. But I can understand why it was made a comedy, because there were several times throughout this book that I just laughed at myself and thought, and sometimes exclaimed, what is this guy doing? What is he thinking?
He is extremely unintentionally hilarious in his actions. He just keeps shooting himself in his own foot over and over and over and over again.
Yeah, it's really interesting, because the only reason all this fraud stuff was discovered was because he went to the FBI about price fixing first. So it did seem that he was trying to do the right thing. And what it kind of comes off to me as, he knew this price fixing stuff was bad and potentially hurting innocent people. And I don't think he viewed him taking money from ADM as something that was harmful. Per se. But I think when he first went to the FBI about price fixing, he didn't really consider how that would put him in a situation of being uncovered to have committed pretty substantial fraud.
If you are involved in any sort of FBI investigation, you should assume that you're going to be watched, you're going to be monitored, and they're probably going to find out stuff that you didn't want them to. So again, there's so many times in the story where I just don't understand how he couldn't shut up. But I guess some of the mental disorders that you went over could explain some of that. But man, this guy, my God. And with that, I believe it's time that we come to the verdict portion of our podcast. We explain this every time. In case this is your first podcast, how this works is we give the film a verdict. Either the film can be declared not guilty, which means it got most of the information correct. It's a very accurate representation of the true story. A mistrial, which means they got some stuff right, but changed a lot of things still. But the bare bones of the story is still there. And of course, the guilty verdict, which means they basically changed everything, and it is not really at all close to the true story behind it. So, Ashley, what verdict do you give Steven Soderbergh's The Informant?
So this is a pretty easy decision for me. And unlike our dear friend, Mr. Whitaker, I'm going to give this film a not guilty verdict. And this is why. You had said that at the beginning, the film has the little caveat that some people are composites of each other. And I actually looked at the casting list to see kind of who was who and who all was all included. And they actually included like so many more people than I had thought when you had told me that that was the case. I think a lot of the people that they do include are based on actual people and are related to how they are related to these cases. I also think that even though the film left out a lot, they included most of what was necessary to the real essence of this story. This book is a beast. It is like in 10-point font, and it's just riddled with new information, like most nonfiction books about complex crimes are. I was also impressed about how Soderbergh was able to reduce that to a 2-hour movie.
I am in total agreement. This is a unanimous decision. The Informant gets a not guilty from me as well. I was continuously astounded at the amount of things that the film got correct as you were telling us the true tale. I was just flabbergasted the entire time. The stuff that was left out was stuff that was pretty inconsequential to the story as a whole. And I thought it was really well done and surprisingly accurate. The amount of money embezzled, the specific locations, dates, it was all there on film. And it's very impressive. I wholeheartedly give The Informant a not guilty and a recommend verdict for anyone who has not seen it yet.
Good job, Steven Soderbergh. You are in the prestigious Not Guilty Club. Cheers to you. Remy, what are we going to be talking about next week?
Next week, we have our very first Nicolas Cage film, which I'm pretty sure most of you have not seen before. Neither of us had seen it or heard of it before doing research to figure out what kind of episodes we were going to do this season. And it is about the true story of the Butcher Baker, which was a serial killer who would kidnap women and then hunt them for sport in the Alaskan wilderness. And the serial killer in the film is played by John Cusack. It is made by a first and one-time director who I can't really remember the name of, but it is coming up next week and it's going to be a crazy story. We have recorded these podcasts out of order, so we have recorded that episode already. And it is a good one. I highly recommend it. And if you are a Nicolas Cage fan, I recommend it even more. We have a little personal story about Nicolas Cage that is included in that episode as well.
However, if kind of more gruesome crimes aren't your cup of tea, I would say that that is going to be the one of the season that you're going to want to skip. This man is just atrocious, and his crimes are brutal.
And with that traumatizing taste of things to come, we will be bringing this episode to a close. And again, if you haven't seen The Informant, I do recommend you check it out. It is a hilarious film. And we hope you come back next week. Please look us up on Instagram and any other social media site that you can think of at Criminal Adaptations on Instagram. Like, comment, subscribe on the podcast. If you give us a good review, we will read it on the show.
And as promised, we have a review to read for everyone. This one comes from our listener, Milky Way, titled Fascinating Podcast. The review says, I really enjoy this podcast. I don't usually like watching true crime movies, but it turns out that I really love hearing about them, at least when it is these hosts telling me about them. I love hearing about the movie and then hearing about the basis for the movie. I am often shocked by the discrepancies. It is fun having an insider's look at both the cinematic process and the legal/factual basis. Thanks for the great podcast. And thank you, Milky Way, for your positive review. We really, really appreciate it. For everyone else listening, if you want a shout out on our podcast, head over to iTunes, the Apple Podcast app, Spotify, or wherever else you listen to podcasts and leave us some love and we will return the favor.
And that is all we got. Thank you so much. We will hopefully see you next time.
Bye-bye.